And I'm thrilled to welcome Chris Packham. Thanks for coming on the show, Chris.
No, pleasure.
Thanks for your time. Now, of course, one thing that's always stood out about yourself is your ingenuity. And by your own admission, you taught yourself photography and invented a job for yourself. So photography was really the starting point in a wildlife career that spanned three decades. How did you get involved in that?
Well, a lifelong interest in the subject. I didn't start taking pictures until I was in my mid-20s. And at that stage, I'd become quite a frustrated artist. I really wanted to go to art college, but ended up doing a zoology degree. It was always a split interest, and at that point, I'd spent so long with my head down a badger set or in a kestrel's nest collecting data and going through my zoological training, which I enjoyed greatly and has been obviously a great asset to me, but I really just wanted to start making some things. And I started doing, experimenting with all sorts of different media, and then picked up a camera and started to take pictures of wildlife, which seemed the obvious subject because it was obviously closest to my heart. So, I pretty much self-taught, and I continue to do it whenever I can.
Yes,
it's not a process that I particularly enjoy. I find it quite dissatisfying and disappointing. But that's because I'm never satisfied with my pictures. I always want them to be better than they are, and I think that's fairly healthy, because it should be any process like that should be one of continual improvement. So my aim is to just keep getting better as long as I take pictures, basically.
Yeah, so you sound a perfectionist in everything that you do. I mean, did you make many sacrifices to get started in that career?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I there's no need to get the violins out, but I worked very hard. I was very diligent. Once I sort of put my mind to something, then I do it. And whether it was collecting data when I was in my teens or early 20s, which I did rigorously and honestly, and then when I started taking pictures, I bought a rusty old car, and I would drive around the UK sleeping in nature reserve car parks, get up before dawn, clean my teeth in a stream or with a bucket of water, eat a can of beans, and then get going. So, it wasn't posh. I didn't come from a background where there was any alternative. It was a question of just getting out there and doing some hard work, really.
Yeah, really, really living the natural life there, washing in the stream.
Yeah, well, a bit of a vagabond, to be quite honest.
Of course, you support many charities, and Owl Trust being one of them. As your first photograph was sold to Gamekeeper and Countryside magazine, it was of an owl. Has an owl always held a special place in your affection?
Well, I quite like them. They're not my favourite birds, I wouldn't say. They are many people's, but we're lucky in the UK to have some, sort of relatively attractive species. I've been able to photograph quite a few of them, all but my favourite probably, which is the little owl, and I haven't done that since that very first photograph, which was taken way, way, way back in the 1980s. And I photographed this little owl on its nest and sold that, which was the first picture I ever sold and the first one I ever had printed. But subsequent to that, I've never photographed little owls. They're a species that's taken a serious decline where I live in Hampshire. I don't see them anywhere near as regularly as I used to do. In fact, I would say that, these days you have to go looking for them rather than come across them, which is a bit of a shame. But maybe one day I'll get the chance to photograph them again.
You never know. It'd be nice to catch up with that original owl, wouldn't it, that posed for you?
Yeah.
If we ever find him. Now, of course, this photo led on to the next shot and the next shot, and a great analogy that Stephen Bolwell, the wildlife filmmaker, took you under his wing and trained you as a cameraman. And this way you sort of got very close to feeding, as you mentioned, the ever-changing menagerie. Was this both a messy and illuminating experience?
Well, yeah, keeping animals is always messy. The floor's covered in mud this morning on account of Mr. Itchy and Scratchy. I've always enjoyed that close contact with animals. You can learn a tremendous amount from them. I don't keep as much now because I'm not there to look after it, and I very fervently believe that you shouldn't keep any animals unless you're going to act very responsibly towards their welfare. So, my dogs are the epicenter of my own little universe. They get an unnatural amount of care and attention, I should imagine. But when I was a kid, I kept lots of animals, and the house was always full of one thing or another, making a mess on the carpet. But
your parents were thrilled.
Yeah, well, they were thrilled and tolerant too, so I was very lucky in that context.
Wonderful. Would you say there were major differences between studying and filming the animals?
I think that there, you can't be successful, you know, with the filming unless you know your subject, because it's all, sometimes it's about predicting its behaviour and understanding when it's likely to do it and where. And so therefore, good knowledge of the subject is a great asset. Same with the photography. Photography, obviously, you're eminently trying to predict what the animal is going to do and to try and get it into a position, or you get yourself into a position where it looks good enough for a photograph. And so knowledge of its behaviour and its ecology and its likely course of action is really important. So, I mean, I should imagine that I would be a more successful wildlife photographer than, say, a photographer of architecture.
Yes.
Because the buildings, as much as I love them and can enjoy them, they don't hold the same fascination for me that, you know, that wildlife does.
No, it's preempting the moment, I should imagine, just being that one step ahead of what it's going to do from knowing its behaviour, like you say.
Yes, very much so. Sometimes.
Yeah. And when the public send in their shots to Springwatch, and you must know what it takes to stake out there and wait for that crucial shot of nature and pure beauty, do you know what they've been through? Would you need a particular kind of eye?
Well, I think so. You have to have a rigorously critical eye. I mean, I look at all of my photographs and I see error in all of them, which is why I don't particularly enjoy them, and none of them are hung on my wall. But I'm able to exact that on to anyone else's photograph. Sometimes it makes me very unpopular because I can point out the most subtle errors in the photograph, which to me are very important. So I have to say that, you know, last year in Springwatch we had 55,000 photographs sent in. Amongst them were some truly astonishing images, which I, you know, would struggle to find fault with, to be honest with you. But then that's because I didn't take them. You know, had I taken them, I'd have known. But, so I do enjoy looking at other people's photographs, and they certainly send in some fantastic work to Springwatch and whatever.
Yes.
But, yeah, I mean, if people say to me, you know, would you want to look at my photos? What do you think? I'm never one to hold my tongue. I don't see the point in that. You know, if people want a critique, I'll give it. It's an opinion. I'm not necessarily right or wrong. I respect that. I'm not the, you know, I don't consider myself some sort of photo guru, but I mean, if there's a big piece of grass sticking across the front of the animal's face, I don't care how big its smile is, the picture's no good, and I'm going to say so. You know?
Yes, an honest opinion, that's very important when people are learning. Now, of course, what's the longest time you've ever waited for that elusive shot?
I've waited more to see animals than to photograph them, to be honest with you. Photography is all about prediction, and you should minimise the weight and maximise your working time with the animal so you get better success. So I can't remember. I mean, sometimes, yes, you wait 3 or 4 hours for something to happen, and you spend, I mean, this winter I was photographing foxes, and I was lying in the snow for the best part of 8 hours, you know. So, yes, it was freezing cold. By the end of it, my hands weren't working. I was pretty fed up, but I got some pictures, so that's what it costs, that's what it takes. And a lot of the time, you know, you're thinking, constantly thinking, you know, what would I do if the fox turned up there now? So you need to be constantly mentally active, because obviously when the animal does arrive, very often you don't have very long to get the picture, so you've got to have pre-thought about it. If you haven't, you've left it too late.
Really. Yes, you've almost got to be as cunning as the fox to sort of outwit it, really.
Yeah, well, outthink it. I mean, you've got. I mean, it's about picture making, and there's so many more components than the fox. There's the light, there's the landscape, there's a vast multitude of factors when you're making a picture. Inevitably, at the end of that process, the subject's irrelevant. You should have dealt with that long ago. Long ago being sometimes fractions of a second, but in that point when you press the button, the subject, I'm not really looking at it, really. You know, I'm looking around the frame to make sure that the picture might work, you know?
The whole composition of the shot,
yeah,
if you like.
Yeah,
of course, exactly. Another facet to your work is a show called 100 Things That Caught My Eye. And it must be hard to stop at 100, but I guess this really is a journey of the senses. Is there anything that you sort of wish that you'd captured but you haven't?
Oh, my goodness, loads of things. yeah, there's a great catalogue of uncaptured images, which I run through from time to time to punish myself. keep myself sharp so I don't miss the next one. I seriously have a little file on my laptop which is pictures that have failed, and I do look at them, and I do punish myself, because, you know, life's short, opportunities sometimes to photograph animals, you know, are fleeting. And if you want to make a good job of it, you've got to make sure that you're on the ball. And on the ball means, as I say, it's, a lot of people think photography is a sort of a practical process, a technical process. I would argue that it's not. It's far more an intellectual process. If you don't think about it, you don't get great results. So I spent a lot of time thinking about what I did wrong to make sure I don't do it again.
Yeah. It's this perfectionist streak coming out again, isn't it? Now, of course, is it a dream come true to get close to creatures only seen in textbooks? Are there any animals who have exceeded your expectations and those who have disappointed?
I don't think any have disappointed other than human beings, to be quite honest with you. You know, and you're right, it's a dream come true. I never dared dream as a child that I would have the opportunities to meet as many animals as I have, or get close to them, or travel to see them. I frequently stop and pinch myself, quite literally, to sort of make sure I'm awake, because it's an extraordinary opportunity that I've been gifted. And I can't think that any have ever let me down, to be honest with you. Sometimes the encounters have been brief and frustrating, but at the end of the day, it's a pleasure to meet every type of animal. It's not just the big sexy things like tigers and some of the more exotic birds. I mean, it's always a treat to meet something, you know, that slimes and slithers, because intrinsically there's always a story behind it, and that's often more interesting, indeed even more beautiful than the animal, to be honest with you.
Yes, it's all about stories, isn't it? Fascinating animals. Yeah. Now, of course, like a badger yourself, I understand that you fought ferociously for an audition in the up-and-coming children's BBC programme called The Really Wild Show. So what did you have to do to secure that job?
Well, I was a lot of nagging, I suppose, and I went to do a screen test, which, with the benefit of hindsight, was cringeworthy, but must have ticked a few boxes for the producer. There's a marvellous man called Mike Bainan. And I mean, at that time I was quite frustrated. I'd come from the school of punk rock. We it's a do-it-yourself ethos. You know, if you want something done, get on and do it yourself. And if something's in the way, get it out of the way and get on with it. So, I people close doors in my face, I'll kick them open, basically. That's the attitude. I'm a doer. I'll stop and talk. I'll consider, I'll rethink. I hope to maintain that ethos, but at the end of the day, I'm interested in action and reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what it was, really. I suppose I just champed away, and eventually I was very lucky to get the job, but I'd done a bit of nagging.
Yes, very lucky and skillful. A bit of badgering going on there. So. Now, of course, animal lovers, we learn to watch wildlife, and we see how they think and adapt on their feet. But did you have to think on your feet when you were presenting that? You had to present your own item.
Well, we were given I've never been given any training. I mean, very kindly from time to time, people have said, you know, can you try doing it this way? But that, to be honest with you, has been quite a rarity. I don't watch much TV. I don't watch other people presenting and think, oh, I'd like to do it like that. I've just done what's come naturally to me. And as I say, from time to time, people, Mike particularly in the early days, would offer some, you know, tips from time to time. But you know, again, it was a self-taught job. It was turn up and get on with it. And then, you know, in those days, I occasionally would watch myself on TV to, you know, recordings to see what had gone right and what had gone wrong. But I find that process a bit cringeworthy. I don't watch myself on TV and haven't done for very many years now. So I just do what I do, really, which is try and infuse and in an informative way about the subject. But yeah, it was a bit of a... Well, it was a bit of a turn up and get going sort of job, you know.
Yeah, well, that's what makes it so fascinating, I guess. And it really made you sit up and take notice. I know when I used to sit there avidly watching the programme, and you'd always hold some exotic spiny-haired creature in your hand. But, of course, it was your magnificent hair, which also added to the wildness. Did you enjoy adding a little punk to the Really Wild Show?
Well, I'd just say I enjoyed it. I mean, it was that or nothing, really. I was majorly into the music. I still listen to it now. I still, you know, like that type of music, even if it's contemporary. I like people who've got something to say, you know, because, as I say, life's short, and you should. I don't like fence sitters of any kind. You know, I'm never. You know, you have an opinion. You can change it, of course, but you should voice it and make sure that you take action on that account. So that's just the way it was, really. And of course, part and parcel of that whole thing was the physical appearance, which meant multicoloured hair and rather daft clothes.
And did you find being a punk and looking less conventional was a little bit too much for the traditionalists, particularly at places like the BBC?
It was initially, to be fair, with some of the old school, but I've always hoped that my enthusiasm and love for the subject would shine through, and that would overcome any preclusions based on the appearance. But and I think it did in the main. There were one or two people who just sort of didn't get it at all, you know. But then that was part of it, wasn't it, really? I mean, if you're going to do, in those days, I mean, talking a long time ago now, if you were going to make that sort of statement, it was for a purpose. And then part of the purpose was to create a very clear separation between the way I wanted to live and act and the way that I thought they did.
Yes.
So, you know, to a great extent, from my point of view, you can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't, upset someone with your physical appearance and expect them to love you the next minute.
Yes, that's true. I mean, in your experience, have you found all the really intriguing wildlife experts to be a little bit eccentric in some way?
Many of them, but only because they have very focused interests. So I wouldn't call that eccentric. I would call it maybe sometimes obsessive, and as I say, very dedicated and focused. But, you know, those people are the best people on earth for me. I'll listen to a man talking about the workings of a washing machine motor if he's a great enthusiast. I like people who are really into stuff like that. You know, I find it easy to respond to them. So
yes, great energy.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. Yeah, dedicated energy.
Definitely. And of course, you've had a dedicated, energetic lady, of course, a phenomenal lady, very instrumental in getting you your first wildlife presenting job. Can you tell us about her and about that job?
Well, I was very fortunate. I've had a number of people who have acted as real mentors, from my biology teachers at school and college, all the way through to people in the BBC. It was a lady called Marion Zuntz, and then Dillis Breeze, who were helpful. Mike Bain and the producer of The Really Wild Show was someone who eventually opened the door for me and gave me that opportunity and was a great asset for a long time. But, you know, there have been many more since, and I think that one of the things that I long ago learned is that, you know, television is teamwork, and everyone has to give their best and work as hard as they're able to produce the best possible product. And in the main, I've worked in teams where that's the case. I really don't like working with people who aren't going to die for the cause, you know, because these days you have to, because there are a lot of pressures on us in terms of time and money and opportunity.
Yes, you have to really stand for something, don't you?
Yeah, everyone works really, really hard, and particularly at the moment on Spring Watch and Autumn Watch, I've been fortunate to work with some great people, and they really do pull every stop out to make sure that the programmes are as good as they possibly can be at that time.
Yes. Well, I guess you've had so many inspirational people in your life, and having won the award, the Dillis Breeze Medal, you must feel great joy at that. And did Dillis's work spur you on to find inspiring wildlife stories?
Well, Dillis was, a producer at the BBC, and she was very much about, that her ethos was about communicating stories. She gave myself and Steve, lots of work, which was great, and she was always there with happy to have a cup of tea. And when after she'd retired, I see her at all sorts of ornithological events. She was very keen on her birds, and she was secretary, I think, of the British Trust for Ornithology for a long time. Yes, it was. Quite a romantic edge, really, to receive the award, since I'd known her relatively well, and as you say, she'd been instrumental in helping me in my early career. So it's, I find receiving awards quite difficult. I'm sure there are many more worthy people out there than me. I'm always very self-conscious about that, if I'm honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
But if I had to choose one, then that would be the one on the list, really.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, of course, I'm talking about ongoing work. I mean, last year I was at the BBC and the Surrey Wildlife Trust A Wild Day Out, which was fabulous, and I heard all about the upcoming Wild Night In. Did you feel proud to be involved in helping to raise more than £1 million for conservation projects?
Well, to be honest with you, my job is largely vocational. Of course, I'm paid for it. But at the end of the day, the reason I do it is because I want to make a difference, a positive difference for wildlife. And I spend as much time as I can trying to, in my own small way, influence that positive change. So, yes, of course, it needs tremendous support, it needs increased awareness, it needs people to understand the problems and to give, sometimes to give cash, and other times to give their time and energy and commitment to the cause. So it was great to raise £1 million, and it's been going to some great projects too, which is really heartening.
Do you think there's something to be said by when we can see about the species, sort of seeing is believing, and then we can care more about it?
Definitely. I mean, I think, I'm standing here in my kitchen looking into the garden, and I'm watching a whole flock of chaffinches beneath my feeder and masses of great tits and blue tits chucking food out of it onto the ground, which doesn't work in terms of the system. These aren't my birds. I can't claim them. I don't own them. But nevertheless, they're the ones that I'm standing here and enjoying. So I would say that community conservation, looking after the creatures that you share your community with, is wherever you are in the world, is the best way forward, because these are the animals that you should best understand, are best able to help and protect, and ultimately those that you can enjoy. So it's a win-win-win situation with community conservation. So, of course, I love tigers, and of course I want to look after whales and everything else, but our British wildlife is possibly closest to my heart on that account, really.
Absolutely. Of course, many hundreds of people find the big cats very fascinating. But what I love about your presenting is how you champion the small mammal, like the shrew. Did you always find yourself fascinated by what lay in the undergrowth?
Yeah, well, it's the story that's more interesting than the animal sometimes, So, as I say, it doesn't need to be big and fierce and sexy for me to be interested in it. If it's slimy and tiny, if it's got a great story, then that's great. That's what really intrigues me. And a lot of people, I suppose, sometimes the big stuff's a bit of a turn off because so many people are into it and so much is known about it. It's more interesting to find out new things about little creatures, or less inspiring, to many people.
Yes, I
do. I've always been following. Same with photography too. I mean, I've been photographing tigers this winter, and that's great. But I'm really looking forward to some time that I've managed to secure this summer to photograph insects again, because, normally I'm working in the summer, I don't get a lot of time. But I'd rather come up with a really good photograph of some little bug than a photograph of a tiger, because so many people are trying with tigers, and there are so many good pictures. And when people see a tiger picture, they're naturally going to like it. If they see a picture of a damselfly, I've got to try harder to make them like it, and I like that challenge.
Yes, absolutely, because they've got all sorts of new technology to obviously get right up close to the to the tigers and the lions now, but it is a small insect, because insects are, as you well know, so crucial. They're kind of an unsung hero, really, aren't they?
Well, you need a food chain, don't you? Without it, you can't have anything at the top.
Absolutely.
So, yes, everything has a role to play, and you can't say that any part of it is any more important than the other, because if you pull it out, the whole lot starts to function less efficiently.
Yes.
So, my chaffinches are not the best bird in the world, but when the sparrowhawk comes around the corner on account of the vast number of them that I'm currently looking at, then you can tick that box, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, they kind of draw other ones in towards them, don't they? And I guess for small mammals and creatures, those hedgerows are very crucial, and many of nature lovers and the Surrey Wildlife Trust are aware of the importance of creating corridors. Do you see this as the way forward for conservation long term?
Well, I'm very keen to support the Wildlife Trust's Living Landscape program, which they're running at the moment, and this is all about joining up valuable parts of our landscape, sometimes nature reserves, sometimes areas which have just been naturally left to hold a large repository of species. I'm not one for collecting more and more isolated packets of land and wrapping them up in fences and spending a lot of money protecting them. I think we have to think of the bigger picture, and that's what the Wildlife Trusts have been doing. So, yes, Surrey Wildlife Trust are very much on board with this, and they have their own schemes and plans which will maximise the goods that they do in the Surrey landscape. And we've got a limited amount of money, and we've got a limited amount of time to make a difference, so it's important that we maximise our efficiency, and that's what this scheme is all about, then.
Yes, you sort of touched on it just there, really, but I guess it's an older view of conservation, maybe. You could sort of liken it to a human being stuck on a desert island. I guess conservationists have to be careful, like you say, not to fence off certain species in their attempt to protect a so-called vulnerable species.
Yeah, well, if you wrap them up in tiny, they are islands. Sometimes you'll find a nature reserve and it's surrounded by incompatible habitat, farmland, or whatever it happens to be, And as a consequence of that, it becomes an island, and islands are intrinsically fragile and not sustainable. So we don't like islands. We want to join them up, and sometimes corridors are what's required, as you say, hedgerows or watercourses, which are managed with wildlife in mind. There are many ways of affecting this network, but that's what we're after. We just got to raise the funding and make sure that we put the whole process into action.
Yes, yeah, so as you know, birds obviously can fly, but the corridors really are essential for the small, medium-sized mammals who can't get around so easily. Mm-hmm. Are you starting to see benefits from the smaller mammals being able to move from one landscape to another?
Well, we know it works. Mm-hmm. You know, it works in theory, it works in practice. It's been tested. But what we're not doing and not able to do at the moment is to affect it over a large enough area quick enough, and that's why we're still seeing serious declines in some of our species. Worrying declines, terminal declines. Mm-hmm. So, you know, now is the time for action, and that's why, again, I'm very keen to keep reminding people that, you know, they must exercise their conscience to make a positive difference for wildlife, really.
Yes, well, if you've mentioned everything in the environment, it's about joining up spaces, and many people know about animals and the food chain, but it's how we shop for our food that some might say has a chain reaction, would you say?
Well, I would. We expect food too cheaply. This means that we don't support a very healthy rural economy in the UK. And at the end of the day, our farmers are governing 86% of our land surface, farmers and foresters. So it's clear to see who's got the future of British wildlife in their hands. And I can't imagine how we have the temerity to go banging on the farmer's door, asking them to do this, do that, do the other, if we're not showing them any support by buying their produce. Because we want the cheapest deal down the supermarket, and that to me is an entirely wrong approach, you know. So we have to do a lot more to support the UK farming fraternity, and then I'm sure that they'll be more keen to support us. And I also think, you know, that if we want the landscape managed the way we want it for wildlife, then we should put our hands in our pocket and pay for it. Frankly,
yes,
we're not paying them enough for the food they produce, and this is putting terrible pressure on them, and. That's not the way forward.
Basically. Yes. I mean, how do you feel when you come across people who say they love animals and the environment, yet they still buy cheap supermarket food, which is using pesticides?
Well, it's an educational exercise. We just need to change people's minds. We need to, you know, tell them that basically, if they want that sort of lifestyle, it's coming with a terrible cost, and the terrible cost will be a future disaster for the landscape and. And we know that it won't work in terms of production of food either. We need that range of wildlife out there for the system to work. So the practice that we're in at the moment, one that we've learned, is flawed, and we need to change it. It's just very difficult telling people that they've got to spend more money on food in this country, because everyone has got used to cheaper food, and it's all about bargains. That's what the wretched adverts are about all the time. It's not about quality, is it? Sometimes it's a question that, you know, you get a bit of quality in there, but it's all about cheaper this, cheaper than the other, and it's soul destroying.
Yes.
And if I was a farmer, I don't think I could watch TV at all. To be quite
yes, honest. Those who are trying to do things the ethical way must find it very difficult.
Very frustrating. Go to your farm shop, spend a bit more. When you go to the supermarket, buy produce which has been sourced locally. To show that the supermarket, manages that's what you want. I don't think many people can avoid visiting supermarkets in the UK now, at least not the vast majority of the population, but when you go there, you still have a choice. Exercise that choice for the benefit of our farming friends and all the wildlife that lives out there.
Yes, there is always a choice, and if enough people do it, then the supermarkets have nowhere to go. Now, I guess one of the reasons many people sometimes do little about wildlife is they feel very helpless in the grand scheme of things. But we hear it's the end, you know, for certain species, and people don't realise that they can actually do practical things every day in our back garden, for example.
Yeah, well, I'm standing here looking at a mountain of food that I put out this morning, and it's covered in birds, and that's making a difference. And they'll nest in, some of them will stay to nest in my garden because I put up nest boxes. You know, we should all empower ourselves because we can all make a small difference, and that adds up to a big one, and that's the same with everything in life, isn't it, really? So. Yeah, I mean, remember, we are the do-it-yourself nation. So, you know, if you have any opportunity to help wildlife in any way, shape or form, then take it, because don't think that the conservators are out there doing everything. Like, there's not enough of us, and we don't have enough resources. We need your help.
Yes, definitely. Now, of course, with a symbol like the WWF being devoted to this animal, do you feel certain animals like the panda are being too singled out as being in danger, and that's actually more dangerous for other animals in the long term?
Well, in the past, we've concentrated on the big and the fluffy and the cute, which is pathetic, and we now know that we have to look after everything, as we've already, you know, been discussing. As a consequence of that, pouring, you know, millions and millions into one species is not a current practice that we should continue to employ. We have to look after landscapes and entire ecosystems. It's difficult and it's expensive. So I would say that conservation urgently needs an audit to see where its money's going and to reorganise it so it's spent most efficiently. That would be my point on that, really.
Yes, and of course it is encouraging that the otter, you know, through the byways, once again slightly like the corridors, the byways being created to allow them from get from one river to another is quite encouraging as well.
Yeah, otters are spreading their range. They're not consolidating their population yet, but there aren't enough otters. We can't, you know, take our foot off the gas. We need to continue to work hard to conserve otters, because although they've spread, they haven't spread yet in great numbers. So we have to be careful here not to preemptively celebrate the return of a creature when there's only six of them.
Yes, of course. And of course, on the subject of the grey squirrel being a case in point, they sort of besieged parts of Scotland, but we're sort of segregating the red squirrel to places like Brown's Island and the like. But how can you stop nature doing what nature does?
Well, we manage nature. We live in a manscape. Every square metre of our country is managed by us. And we've learned how to do it with best effect to help certain species. So, but, you know, that's a choice that we have, and that's one that we can enact. And we do have policies which, you know, look after red squirrels. In the longer term, you know, we're going to need a vaccine to protect them from the disease that the greys spread to them. But as a stopgap method, what we do is we, in certain areas, control the population of grey squirrels. But, you know, that's not sustainable economically or anything else. So we've got to be more creative in conservation to come up with new ideas and modernise.
Mm, that's right. And if I'm correct in quoting, you've been saying you don't believe in creating museums for animals, and I'm not talking about the natural history museum variety.
No. Well, some nature reserves are museums, and they're just packets of the past that we wrap up. And that's a past policy that we should forget. I mean, I personally wouldn't acquire any more nature reserves unless they fit into a program such as the Wildlife Trust Living Landscapes. Mm-hmm. I just don't see spending more money to do that unless they are part and parcel of that sort of future design for the British countryside.
Yes. Yeah. Is there one specific animal, if you had to be pinned down on this, that you'd be devastated to see extinct?
Well, there's one that I fear that I may see become extinct, and it's a very charismatic one. The cuckoo is in catastrophic decline in the UK because of what we're doing to the wider landscape. And I fear that I might live long enough to not hear a cuckoo in spring. And that will be a dreadful failing on my watch, really. I'm not looking forward to that.
No. Well, let's hope all our listeners can do everything they can in their power to make that not be the case.
Get down the farm shop, support your local farmer, and then you can ask him to do something positive for wildlife, because other than that, I think you're being a bit cheeky.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Now, because I understand you're going to be shortly filming a documentary that focuses on good conservation ideas and how we can implement more of them, and also what can be done properly. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, I'm not going to make any friends there. I mean, it's going to be a very hard-nosed look at what we're doing right and wrong. We've touched on some of the issues already. I think that sometimes agitating, being creatively critical is very important, but not many people are prepared to stick their neck out in my business. I am, because I don't need friends, I need to make a difference. So the programme will take a very severe look at contemporary conservation policies in the UK, and it will be critical of some of them, and it will be asking why we're not doing some of the others.
I love your honesty. It's been an absolute joy talking to you today.
All right, thank you.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was the delightful Chris Packham. Radio.